In this episode of the Bear Performance Podcast.
If you want it bad enough, you can do it. And I mean, just look at what I've done with running. I'm not a great athlete. I just decided it was important to me and I did this. But there's so many people doing it. You have to want to win more than you want to be alive. You have to want to kill everyone in the space and you can't fake your way through that. So it's very important that you figure out what it is that you're passionate about, what you want to do, and then attack.
Welcome back to another powerful episode of the podcast. I'm your host, Nick Bear, founder and CEO of Bear Performance Nutrition. Every week, we bring you insightful stories, knowledge, and inspiration to help you reach your full potential in life, fitness, and business. If you enjoy the message we're promoting in this podcast, we would greatly appreciate it if you would leave a rating and review on the platform you are listening to. Make sure to subscribe so you don't miss out on future episodes that embody the Go One More mindset. All right, ladies and gentlemen, today we have Ken Rideout. What's going on, Ken?
Chilling, buddy. I'm so happy to be here. I'm honored. Thank you for having me.
I saw you hit 10 miles on Lady Bird Lake today.
Every day.
A daily 10?
Every single day. Non-negotiable.
So what's crazy about, you know, as people start getting older, because you're 50 years old now, right?
Yep, 51.
51.
Can you believe it? I can't even believe it. When I say it, it doesn't even sound real. I don't feel old. When I say it, I'm like, oh my God, 51. Damn. That's old.
Well, when people start getting older, they typically downgrade their physical achievements or potential that they want to go after. However, with you, you are chasing greater, harder, larger PRs and achievements. What's driving that? What's making you say, as I get older, I'm only upgrading what I'm going to do?
Extreme insecurity.
Is that what it comes from?
I think a lot of it is. Yeah, a lot of it is extreme insecurity. People ask me all the time, how have you improved during as you've aged? But I didn't get into running till I was in my mid-30s. So I had never been serious about running. So I was starting at a place where I was like a decent runner, not great. And there was a lot of upside. And I trained just like a professional runner trains. I never compensate for age because I don't feel old. And so I don't know what the magic formula is, but I don't feel like I look very old. I don't feel old. My beard gets gray when it grows out. So now I have to shave all the time. I'd rather not always have to shave, but I have to shave now because it does make me look a lot older. And I'm, like I said, I'm very insecure, but I've stayed on top of I've always been very fit and active. And when I discovered running, honestly, when I started to really look at running and start to try to be competitive, I viewed runners as kind of dweebs. And I was like, I bet that if I can outwork and out hustle these guys, I can beat them all. And I literally just convinced myself, whether that's real or not, and, you know, a lot of times it doesn't matter what's real. It matters what you think. If you think something and you act on it, there's like examples throughout history of people that just didn't listen to conventional wisdom. Like if someone told you they were going to start an electric car company and take on the auto industry and they were going to beat the shit out of them and on a regular basis, you'd think they were crazy. But that's exactly what Elon Musk did. I'm not trying to compare myself to Elon Musk, but I viewed running like that. I was like, why couldn't I out-hustle these guys? Like, they don't strike me as like, I had come from a team sport background. I played football and hockey in college and was very competitive. I boxed for the New York Athletic Club. So when I looked at running, I was like, no one's going to punch you in the face, choke you unconscious. It's just you against yourself, suffering in solitude. And then on race day, you get to show up and show off what you've been doing, show all your skills without the threat of someone punching you in the face. I'm like, this is excellent. This is like not very intimidating. And I just set about, literally, I just started running 10 miles a day. And when I would have a race coming up, I would add a long run on the weekends, but with no structure. So it would be like Monday to Friday, I'd run 10 miles every day before work. Then when I got home, I'd either like do some pull-ups and push-ups and or ride my bike on the trainer because I had done Kona, the Ironman in Hawaii 3 times. And I would do a long run on Saturday and I'd ride my bike like 50 to 100 miles on Sundays. And that was my routine for like 3 or 4 years. And I went from a 3-hour marathon to 2:33. And then when I got to 2:33, I tell people, then I started to get serious. And then I got a coach and started to add structured like professional runner type workouts to my routine. And that's when I went from 233 to 228. But always, as I've gotten older, I've run a faster PR either at the marathon or the half marathon every year for like the last 15 years.
Well, it's like I had Matthew McConaughey on the podcast a few months ago. And the one thing he said is, and he truly believes this, that nothing is unbelievable. Mm-hmm. Is his least favorite word is unbelievable.
Yeah.
And it's one thing to say that, like for people to say nothing's unbelievable. But then when someone like yourself and me too, truly believes that, nothing is impossible.
Yeah.
That you can keep getting better and better and better. So that being said, what's the goal? Like, what's the next goal? How far do you want to take it? What do you think is your full potential with running?
I'd love to just keep running faster. What the fastest I can run is, but I don't think running 225 is out of the question at all. I ran 228, 229, 230 a couple times, but I think on the right course, if on the right day, I can do it. I ran a 110 half marathon last November, two or three weeks after the New York City Marathon. And during that race, I was like, holy shit, I'm so strong right now. But the course had a tremendous amount of hills, 600 feet of elevation gain over 13 miles versus 800 over the Boston Marathon, which is notoriously tough. So I was just on one. I never felt so good. It was like one of those magical days. And I feel like if I had that type of day on the right marathon course, I don't know, low 220s. But the goal for now, the immediate goal is I got second at the age group world championships at the London Marathon last October. Then in November, I won my age group in New York, won the masters division there by 3 seconds, 40 and over. And then this past April, I won the age group in the Boston Marathon. So the immediate goal is to try to win my age group at all the majors. I've got Berlin and Chicago in September and October, 2 weeks apart. It's going to be a tough turnaround, but I think it's doable, definitely not unbelievable. And then I'm going to do, hopefully, Tokyo next March, and that will be all six of the majors, and I will have, like, hopefully won my age group in all of them, and then I'll have to go back and clean up London where I got second.
How many races are you doing a year right now, or shooting to do?
Typically, I would do two or three marathons at the most, and then sprinkle in some half marathons based on, like, feel, like when something looks interesting.
But you don't ever do races. I heard you talking about this in a podcast. You don't ever do a race. You don't sign up for a race or an event as a training race or run. No. You treat every race like you're racing to die.
At the fucking turkey trot on Thanksgiving, I'm coming for your neck. I want everything. I'm going to run it as fast as I can. And then I feel silly afterwards if I win by like 10 minutes at the like local turkey trot. But when the gun goes off, I'm all in.
So that's a combination of the mental aspect of training and mentality, mindset, and the physical coming together. So I think to really paint that picture, because a lot of people might look at you and say, oh, Ken's just the perfect picture of success.
He's opposite.
He's got this business. He's fast. He's fit. He's 51 years old. But I think to really paint the picture and give it justice, we need to take it back to like your childhood, and I know you went through some hard times of addiction.
Yep.
So I'd love to talk about like what that childhood looked like, because one of the things that really grabbed my attention, and I know you were a little older at this point, but when I heard you talk about this in an interview, you were working at a prison, and part of your family at the time were inmates at this prison.
Yeah.
And I never heard that before from anyone, but you know, as we were talking before recording, you said it's pretty common.
Yeah.
I'd love to just paint this picture of what childhood and growing up looked like before endurance training was never even a thing.
Yeah. I was, as a young kid, I was heavily involved in youth hockey. So I played hockey with some NHL superstars, Sean McGeachran, Keith Tkachuk, the Sacco brothers. They're just elite NHL all-stars. They were my peers as kids. We were all pretty equal. And then at some point in like high school, basically, they just got like better, like miles better, where I'm like, what the hell? We're doing the same thing. How are these guys like so far ahead of me? And, but I think that's what happens with all elite athletes. Like at some point, all the best pro athletes, they're playing with their friends. And then at some point it's obvious that they're elite and they just start moving ahead. So I was very involved with that, but I was growing up in a house that was incredibly unstable. My parents were divorced, so I lived with my mother and eventually a stepfather, but prior to that, it was like whoever she was dating at the time, and it was not a warm and fuzzy environment like my own children have now. But that was my motivation when I had my own kids, is to give them the life essentially that I didn't have. not for material, excuse me, not for material possessions, but just for like love and inner peace. Like I just was never had like inner peace as a child. It was wrought with anxiety. It was very unstable. My mother's brother lived downstairs from us. We lived with, at times, with my mother's mother. So it was like my uncle, her brother, was a lifelong heroin addict. So there were always junkies around. And then eventually my brother, who's a year younger, would end up as an inmate in the prison I worked at, due primarily to drug abuse and decisions around. Like I always tell people, people in jail typically aren't, like no one robs a bank when they're sober. Those are the acts of a drug addict. That's like the acts of someone who's like out of their mind and thinks that that's a good idea, that they're going to get away with robbing a bank. So most of the people there have drugs are a big part of why people are there. But so growing up, it was a balance between the instability of being at my house, and then my dad would come and get me and take me to hockey. And at the time, you know, that was like my saving grace, if you will. But in time, I just came to realize that it was almost like more for him than for me. My parents had me when they were really young, and 19 and 20. So, you know, when I'm 10 years old, my dad's only 30. But, you know, this was almost like his outlet and his way to connect with me. But I, you know, I loved it at the time, and I still look back at it with fond memories, but it affects the way that I bring my own kids to sports. I don't want to be too involved. I just want them to try their best and have fun. I don't care. I tell them all the time, you don't have to be good. You can be the worst person there, but the only thing you can't do is not try. As long as you're trying hard, we're good. That wasn't the case when I was a kid. If I didn't play well, I would get yelled at the whole way home. I mean, I would be like yelled at until I was crying. And I would always think like, do you think I'm not trying out there? So it was like, in hindsight, it was traumatic. But at the time, you just don't know any different. Everyone was doing this crazy shit. Like that's just the way people lived there. It wasn't, like I said, it wasn't actually a hotbed for intellects. And so yeah, when I graduated from high school, one of the guys, I did okay in high school football. And one of the teams we played against, the coach was the warden at the prison. And he said, hey, come and see me for a job in the summer. So I went there thinking I would cut grass or whatever. And they handed me these police uniforms and gave us a half a day of classroom training of what to look for. What it was crazy in hindsight, and walked us into this men's prison, and it was on. But, you know, growing up in the inner city, it wasn't uncommon to know most of the inmates. Prison's a very segregated place. So I knew most of the white, and I grew up in a pretty racist place. So there wasn't like blacks and whites didn't really congregate with each other per se. I mean, I had some friends that were black, but it was worlds away from where we are today. So when I got there, it was just like, I knew people, like I said, my stepfather had been an inmate there, and I'd known people in and out of prison. So it wasn't as shocking as it sounds for me at the time, but it was still very intimidating to be 18 years old and in this prison, and it's dangerous and everything that goes with it. But one of my partners that I worked there with was Mickey Ward, who was had three legendary fights with Arturo Gatti, who was the topic of the movie, inspiration for the movie The Fighter, played by Mark Wahlberg. And his brother was an inmate during the time that we both worked there, Dick Yecklin, who fought Sugar Ray Leonard, who was played by Christian Bale in the movie. So it was, there was never a dull moment there, but man, that experience really motivated me to focus on studying and like work on getting a degree and figuring out what I wanted to do next with my life, because working there was not an option.
When you went into that position, was that something you thought of as, I'm going to make a career out of this?
Initially, you know, yeah, I was like, oh, cool, civil service job, good benefits, shows you like how growing up in that environment, like you're convinced that sounds like a viable option. If my kids told me now that they wanted to do that, I'd be like, if that's what you're passionate about, you want to do it, go for it. But maybe start out with some like bigger dreams. The inmates, I found most of the guards, with few exceptions, but most of the guards were 10 times worse than the inmates. They were terrible people for the most part. Some of them were cool, and then they know who they are, and I'm friends with them, like Mickey Ward. But some of them were just complete jerks. They were like failed like stormtroopers. They wished that they were in some form of law enforcement, and they were at the like bottom rung, like, you know, bossing around inmates. But, you know, people also think it's like a Shawshank Redemption where you're in there just bullying inmates. If you piss off an inmate in a prison, they will punch you right in the face without even thinking about it. They'll stab you in the neck. It's dangerous. So it's like that fine line of commanding and expecting respect, but you get the respect that you give to others in a weird way. It's very fine line. I always would say to the inmates that I knew, it's enough for you to know that I'm going to do what I have to do. So don't do shit in front of me that compromises my integrity. But I was friendly with a lot of them to a certain extent, but I wasn't going to look the other way when they committed atrocities against each other, which wasn't uncommon.
You think it's still like that in the prison system?
Yeah, it's a super dangerous place.
That's wild.
Yeah, man. Those guys, people are under the impression, like I said, Shawshank Redemption, the guard banging the stick along the cage, along the bars of the cells. You tried to do something like that. You wake those guys up when it's not time to be awake. They'll throw like scalding hot oil on you. They'll boil oil in a cup with like a little stinger, a little electrical heating element, and they'll throw it on you. And you can't rub hot oil off you. It burn your skin right off. They'll throw a cup of urine on you, feces. They'll get you. You don't want to have, you don't want to give them problems. Like, if you're a jerk, they're going to get you. You just have to do your job and be respectful within reason.
Is it hard to disassociate between work and going home in that kind of environment?
I mean, now it's a world away. So yes, now, I mean, my wife will always remind me, like when I'm telling the kids how to defend themselves, or like someone was picking on them I would never let them stand for that, because there's four of them. I'm like, I don't care who it is. No, if four against one, you guys shouldn't have any problems. But when I tell her, like, when I'm telling them like how they should handle certain situations, my wife is always quick to be like, you realize that there hasn't been a fight in their school since like the 70s. There's not going to be a fight in school. I'm like, well, if there is a fight, I want to make sure that we're on the right side of it. But yes, and to a certain extent, it's hard for me to dissociate that part of my life, just because, you know, it's like a natural defensiveness. You like always on guard, always ready. In that environment for hostilities. And it's been a long adjustment process in getting comfortable with where I am in my life now, that like, I'm not going to get into a fight, you know? And it's like, sometimes I can have a quick response to things where my first reaction is like, do you want to have a physical problem here? And my wife would be like, dude, what are you doing? I'm like, I think this guy is like trying to start a fight with me. And she's like, are you crazy? And I'm like, I hope so, because like no one wants to have a fight. It's like one of the things I always talk about with racing and being nervous and anxious. It's like everyone is feeling the same feelings. Like before a fight, I was lucky enough to help Teddy Atlas train Alex Vozdik, the light heavyweight champion of the world, for a huge title unification fight against the Russian kid Artur Beterbiev. It was a huge pay-per-view fight on ESPN. I was in the corner with Teddy, and that feeling in the locker room before you walk out there for a fight, I don't care who you are. And I've interviewed every champion in the UFC, multiple boxing world champions. Everyone is scared. The difference is how different athletes process the fear and how it manifests itself. Teddy Atlas would say that fear lets you know that it's time, you're ready. And it's like basically getting your nervous system on point and ready to fight, if fighting is the subject that we're preparing for, or the sport we're preparing for. But it's the same thing with a running race. You know, when you get to your, you're doing Buffalo, right?
Yeah.
When you get to Buffalo, you're going to be anxious the night before. You're probably not going to sleep well, not because you're scared you're going to get hurt, but because you have goals that you want to achieve. There's like pressure associated with that, even if it's your own pressure. But you know, and I know, no one cares about your result except you. No one cares if you finish that race, really. I mean, people, of course, your friends support you. They love you, but they're going to love you if you don't even finish the race, right? But you care. And that pressure is a privilege, because if you didn't feel the pressure, it would mean that this is irrelevant to you, right? So I look at it like, and it's hard to do. It's easier to say than do. But when I'm nervous before a race, I'm like, yeah, of course you're nervous, because it matters and you care and it's time And it's like, embrace it. And imagine the poor sucker that never feels that pressure, never feels anxious about a race or an event or anything. It's like, what a shitty, boring, mediocre life. I want to be uncomfortable, not as a badge of honor or like, hey, look at me. I don't need attention. I know who I am, but I crave that feeling of doubt. Like, oh man, can I do this? Like, I'm not going to like jump off a cliff where I might die. I'm not that kind of risk taker, but I love the idea of challenging myself physically in something that I've trained to do. You know what I mean? It's like, if you're a weightlifter, you want to see how much weight you can lift. If you're a runner, you want to see how fast you can run. And if you're not nervous or anxious about it, then it might not be that important to you.
That's like when you have like a big PR day. Like, I remember when I was strictly strength training, and I knew, you know, in 3 days, I'm going for this big PR on deadlift. And so all I would think about for 3 days leading up, and that morning you wake up, you have this fear, you're nervous.
Yeah.
That fear is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, fear can be really good. And what I've tried to do for these big running workouts leading up to a marathon prep is like, say I have my 20-mile workout, my 22-mile workout. I had a 22-mile workout 2 weeks ago. It's my last like big workout of this build. And I try to replicate that same fear that I have on race day, because I know what that fear provides in terms of results for that workout.
Mm-hmm.
And I go into that workout nervous and scared. Can I complete it? Can I hit my paces? Am I fueling properly? But then you perform and it's like, builds this confidence. Like, oh shit, I can do this. What else can I do?
Yep.
So we need this fear. This fear produces results, and it sets the conditions for you to be able to perform at your highest level.
Yep.
So at what point, I know addiction was like a pretty big point of your life. When did becoming addicted to drugs take over your life?
Yeah, that's a good question. Like I said, when I was a kid, I was always super anxious. I was just not scared, but just I didn't have any inner peace. I didn't like the way I was living. Our house was a piece of shit. I always felt like the roof was going to fall in. I always had these irrational like concerns. Like, I see my kids sometimes, my daughter is always like, Dad, are all the doors locked? And I'm like, we live in a gated community, number one. Number two, why do you think someone's going to come in here? So I try to rationalize with her, but it's an irrational fear that she's just something. It's completely normal. But so I had those kind of same anxieties or emotions when I was a kid, and it carried over when I was an adult. And when I was in my mid-20s and started to have some success in finance, it was like the anxiety was magnified. Now I was like, oh my God, the fear of having money and losing it is even worse than never having it. And I was also incredibly uncomfortable. I've always suffered from a fraud complex or imposter syndrome. I always felt like I fooled them. I'm here. They don't even know I'm here. I tricked them, and I'm here by like, not by merit, but by like shucking and jiving and like, you know, hustling. And I just figured a backdoor entry, and I got on a trading desk on Wall Street, where most people come out of an MBA program or an elite school and they get recruited. And they get into a banking and analyst program where they work through the progressions of working at an investment bank, figuring out, do you like trading? Do you like banking? Like originations, like fixed income, equity. And it's a long story that we could spend an entire episode on it. But once I got into a position where I was on a trading desk and had skipped that whole process through by having good relationships with some of the traders that were customers to these trading desks, it was in just an incredible amount of pressure. And I had a small surgery on my ankle, and I was introduced to Percocet. And when I took those Percocets, I was like, oh my God, I never realized I could feel so carefree and happy and confident. Never. I've never, it's just like it says, I was super high. I was like loving life. Everything was great. And unfortunately, when you get that feeling, it first starts out as like, you know, every couple days, you know, maybe you take them when you have them in the evening after work, and then slowly develops into like, oh, I feel like shit the next morning. I wonder what if I take one of these in the morning to get through the morning in work. And then very quickly it comes to like, now you're just taking them 24/7. And one of the downsides to those drugs is that the physical addiction is incredible. The withdrawals from opioids is something that, I don't know, it to me, it's probably the hardest thing in the world to do, is to withdraw from opioids on your own without going through a program. But I was so ashamed and embarrassed, and I carried this embarrassment with me, internalized for years, going through withdrawals for a week or two, having months of sobriety, then going back through the same cycle again, because those drugs are addictive and they're powerful. And, you know, if you're a weak person, which I was and have been at and struggled with at times, even now, like, I still make mistakes. It's a constant struggle. It sucks. I wish I didn't even know what they made me feel like, because once you know what they make you feel like, it's so easy when things are tough emotionally, and we all have emotional highs and lows. Knowing that that crutch exists sucks. But putting yourself through withdrawals, just, I try to explain to people who don't know, and the people who know, I'm sure, are all shaking their head right now, like, oh, people have no idea, especially people like me that were functioning addicts that, like, suffered in silence and would never tell anyone about your dirtiest secrets, right? But in a recovery, they'll always tell you you're as sick as the secrets you keep. And that's part of the reason I talk about this shit is, like, I'm so ashamed of myself. I'm disgusted. So when you were saying in the beginning of the show, like, yeah, on the surface, I have everything that looks cool, but I don't feel cool because I've, like, made so many mistakes and, like, caused myself so much suffering. You know, I put my wife through some miserable times, just, like, having her know that, like, I was doing this is, it's disgusting. And, but it is what it is. That's me. Like, that's, I'm only as sick as the secrets I keep. If I keep this to myself, who am I helping? I'm not helping anyone. If someone's hearing this and says, if they think that what I've done is impressive in my life, and if that guy can do what he's done and come through this, then maybe there's hope for me too. And I'm here to tell you, like, yeah, you can do it. But it's like one of those things where someone who's not in shape and not into running might be like, I could never get up and run 10 miles a day. But, you know, those people that are running, they might not be able to handle a minute of what these withdrawal symptoms would be, and just be like, and then inevitably you just stay on the merry-go-round and just keep doing drugs. People do it for like a lifetime. And it was a fucking nightmare. And I'm incredibly embarrassed by it, but, you know, that's what happens when you don't deal with the emotional damage that you have sustained. If you don't treat your mental health with the same intensity and with the same purpose that you train your physical health, is that it's very easy to start slipping. Like, you see an older guy and he's in bad shape. Like, you saw him as a young guy, he's fit. Now he's a mess at the high school reunion, and it's like just a slippery slope. You skip the workout one day, eat like shit the next day. Next thing you know, it's 2-3 days, and it's like any kind of bad habits. Why I never take a day off from running. It's like one day off could be the day of new habit of just not being into it. And I like what running has given me. I like I'm incredibly self-deprecating, and inside, like I said, suffer from imposter syndrome and fraud complex, but I'm too insecure to be out of shape. So it's like almost like part of my identity, like a defense mechanism, where I'm just constantly like, if nothing else, I know that I'm at least physically fit. So, you know, that drug addiction changed the trajectory of my life. It's changed my outlook on life, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse. But I can't change the fact that I did that. I've been through that. And this is something that I still struggle with. And I'm here dealing with it and doing the best that I can.
How long did it take you from that surgery and like tasting Percocets for the first time to full?
As soon as I had them, I was like, how do I get more? And I'm a very resourceful person. Like, you know, when I was in college, I used cocaine for the first time, and then was like, maybe for the next like several years, me and my friends in Boston, who were all complete lunatics, we would, you know, go out maybe once a week and get drunk, do coke, and just party crazy. So I had traveled in those circles, but to me, that was like a cool drug. That wasn't like a dirtbag drug like heroin or opioids, which I consider to be like dirtbag drugs. But it's completely irrational. I get it. But was in my mentality was almost like cocaine was like a cooler drug. So it wasn't a problem. But I will also say, like, waking up from a cocaine hangover, usually, I mean, after that first initial introduction period as a young adult, after a while, you're like, this sucks. The aftermath, I always say, tell people cocaine is like the big lie. It sounds so cool and so sexy until you wake up the next day and you're like, oh my God. And there's no like, there's no immediate cure for that hangover. And so as time went by, I just realized like, if I don't drink, I'll never make a decision to do cocaine because I only want to do that when I've been drinking. So I stopped drinking when I moved to New York for like 6 months. And then that problem just eventually dissipated. And then, you know, over the years I've had like slip ups here and there, but you know, like I said, the hangover from that is so, so awful. It, you know, if you do that once every 2 or 3 years, it's a good enough reminder to be like, hell no, dude, I'm not going to throw away a day of my life to do this for a few hours. But, back to your question about the Percocet is once I got a taste for that, once I knew what that was, it was instantaneous. I was like, that's how I want to feel. I could do anything.
I recently read this book. It's called The Molecule of More. Mm-hmm. It's all about dopamine. And it talks a lot about addicts and addictions. It talks about like one of the things with addictions is you stop using the substance to get high anymore. You use the substance to avoid the withdrawal.
100%. That's exactly right. After, if I had been sober for, let's say, a month or two and started using again, I would get the super high, like, incredible feeling for a few days. Then it would, like, almost start to make you physically sick. But you'd still keep, like, thinking, like, one of these times it's going to make me feel good, like, the first time after months and months. And then inevitably it becomes like, I just need to take enough to stay normal throughout the day just because I don't want to go through like being sick. Imagine having the worst flu you've ever had in your life. Everything hurts. Everything. You can't sleep. You're sweating. You're cold. You're hot. And it goes away if you just take more drugs.
How'd you end up getting over that addiction then?
I think torture. White knuckled.
I think I heard you talk about like there's this injection you can take.
That injection is called Vivitrol. Is a like miracle drug. The problem is you have to be sober for at least 7 to 10 days. That 7 to 10 day period is like the withdrawal period. So once you get through that, the Vivitrol shot essentially is just a opioid blocker. So once you take that, you can't get high while you're on it. And it's a 30-day timed release. It's a huge injection that goes in your ass, like an intramuscular injection. And it is like a huge full syringe with a big, heavy gauge, long ass needle that goes deep into the muscle. It's so painful. But once it's in there, it's like a time release thing. So for 30 days, you can't get high no matter what you do. And it keeps you in check because I know because after I took it, after a few weeks, I'm like, let me try and get high. And then you realize you just wasted your money and you don't get high. And if you take too much, you could potentially die from an overdose because your body's still processing the opioids, you're just not getting the opioid receptor high. So to me, it was like a drug that I wish that there was more done to talk about this. And I actually met with the company once with their marketing people. And I was like, you guys should be doing huge PR campaigns around this. People should know that this exists because I promise you that anyone that's whacked out on heroin or opioids, like you said, they're on it now just to avoid getting sick. They're on maintenance. And if they knew that they could suck it up for 7 to 10 days, most people can power through that because not doing it is so painful being on that train. And if they knew how miraculous this drug is, I bet you there would be a lot more people that use it. But I think when you start talking about pharmaceutical industry and all the interests at play, and how much money is out there in Suboxone and Subutex and Methadone and all those drug companies and all their lobbyists preventing like different laws from passing. And without getting into a political discussion, I just think that there are a lot of powerful people at play in preventing the kind of education of the masses that there's a way to stop this. It ain't easy, but once you're in it, it's like, you're in it. Now it's like, that's the way I looked at it. It's like, well, you did this. You're an idiot, but you can either like let the waves crash down or you can come up with a plan and get out of the surf and figure out a game plan. But there's nothing worse to me than seeing someone getting caught in the break and the waves of life are crashing down and they don't have an answer. And they're just kind of looking back at shore like, please, someone come and get me. And you're just kind of like, mother effer, just walk to the side and get out of there. Like make the first step, like come up with a game plan. And I've been good at coming up with a game plan and fixing the problem. I just haven't been good at maintaining that steady level of sobriety where those cravings don't creep up. And it's almost like I use it as a crutch in a moment of weakness, or at least I have over the years. And it's something like, it just haunts me all the time. So when someone says, oh, you inspired me, you did this, I think, dude, I'm struggling every day. I'm like, some days are better than others, but I'm not perfect. No one is. If you don't know the person's full story, you should never look at someone from the outside looking in and assume that anyone has a perfect life. Like I said earlier, things are never as good as they seem, nor are they as bad. They just are what they are.
Yeah, that's one thing I've experienced online too, is people like to, I mean, they get this such a small glimpse of your life and what you're going through at a sliver in time. And people will make a complete judgment of where you live, what your life looks like, what you eat, what your relationship is like. And they paint this picture and they tell a story. And sometimes they'll put words in your own mouth. They'll talk on your behalf. And that's one thing that angers me, is because you don't know what someone else is going through. You don't know what I'm going through. You don't know what my relationship is like right now. You don't know who I lost in my family, or my past, my flaws, or my mistakes that got me to this point. So don't try to put words in my mouth and talk on my behalf. Let me do that.
Yeah.
But it happens all the time.
Definitely.
Right?
Oh, dude. Definitely. And I think you mentioned relationships. I think relationships are a really good reflection of like how you're living your life. Like one of the best decisions I ever made in my life was marrying my wife. I knew that my wife would be the best mom in the world. And she literally is the best mom I've ever seen. That's what she wants to do, to the point where I have to remind her, like, yo, these kids are going to be gone in 10 years. Like, I'm nervous for you, because she went to Vanderbilt. She has a teaching degree. She was an actress, a model. She does still tutors kids privately. She teaches sign language. She has got a little small children's educational business called Bright Signs Learning. She has stuff. But when I tell you, it's like, she's like an NFL player who's playing in the NFL, and the contract's going to be up in a few years. And when you say, like, what else do you want to do? They're like, don't talk to me about it. This is what I want to do. So in that regard, that was the decision I made that has been changed my life. She's put up with my bullshit at times and, like, really helped me get through difficult challenges where other partners might have been like, I'm not going to stick around with this loser while he works out his shit. Like, I know you're not going to work out your crap on my time. Like, I didn't sign up for this. But that's relationships, man. They're a ton of work. You know, one minute you're dating your best friend, the next minute you're running a deadly serious business together. And it's like called a family, and you've got children, and it's who's waking up and who's feeding the kids, who's doing this, who's doing that. 6 months ago, we were just two best friends, like sleeping on the weekends, hanging out, doing whatever we wanted, going on vacations wherever we wanted. We had no expenses. We'd fly first class, stay at the Four Seasons. And now you have an army of people and it needs constant supervision. Those are two completely different lives. So if you don't marry the right partner, that will throw your life into a complete and total state of chaos. Because if you both have so much in common and all of a sudden you have kids and you're both into training, for instance, and you're like, okay, who's going to run first tomorrow? You know, my kids are just at the age now where we can leave them alone for a couple of hours. But yeah, relationships are a big challenge. And like I said, from the outside looking in, it's easy to think like everything's perfect, but every relationship takes work. And if you don't treat it like that, it's going to, like a plant that doesn't get watered, it is not going to look good.
Did you meet your wife when you were going through addiction, or was it after?
I met her after I had gone through the bulk of like the really shitty parts, like the real hard, where I was just figuring out what was going on. I didn't know anything, but now I'm like almost like the addiction expert. Like I knew what needed to be done, but I had some slip ups while I was with her for sure, where she'd be like, you know, realize I was doing this and be like, dude, what the F? And I'm like, I'm sorry. I just, you know, it's mortifying, right? It's embarrassing. It almost like on par with like having an affair. You're like, oh my God, I've been caught doing my like dirty secret. I'm screwed. Like the worst part is that you lose a level of integrity that you can never get back. And that's, like I said, that's something that I have to live with. It kills me. Because I'm like, I know I can never do anything to erase the mistakes I've made. And, you know, to her credit, she is supportive through all this shit. But we have, if we have done anything right, it's raising our kids. That's one thing when people look at it and they're like, you have a beautiful family and the kids. And I say, yes, if there's something that is as good as it looks on social media, it's definitely my kids and the way my wife has raised my kids. Or like, I say she's raised them, but she does 90% of the heavy lifting. It's just her wheelhouse. You know what I mean? She's just awesome at it.
Yeah, four kids, right?
Yep. I have my oldest daughter is adopted. We adopted her from Ethiopia. And then I have three biological boys. They're 12, 11, 9, and 7.
Our first daughter is due July 8th this year.
Oh, man. So exciting. First baby.
Yeah, I can't wait.
Yeah, that period you're in right now, man, that first baby is so exciting. It's and I feel like God does everything perfectly. He's like, let me ease you into this with one newborn baby, like a bag of potatoes. You just put her over there. She just needs to eat in a diaper change for a few months. Let you ease into it. Then they get to like 2-3 years old and they're like, you know, doing crazy, putting shit in the toilet. I got the plumber coming to take the toilet off because I can't figure out what's clogged in the toilet. And it's like a bunch of Legos. And I'm like, why did you put all the Legos in the toilet? And they, you know, they're kids. They're like, I didn't know. We're not supposed to do that. You know, you have to, it's important to remember that they are literally like drunk little people. They have a brain that doesn't really work. It hasn't developed yet. So they don't. That's one of the things that I always struggle with my kids. It's like, why did you guys do this? Why did you leave all the food here? The dog ate everything. And they're kind of like, oh, I guess my brain didn't tell me to like put it away. And that's one of the things that I struggle with the most is remembering that they're kids and they're just not developed yet. They haven't learned everything. And it's easy to get frustrated when they do silly things. So I try to be patient with the first offense, first time offender. But on the second one, I'm like, dude, we had this conversation. Why are you doing this? But yeah, congratulations, man. That's super exciting. It's so much fun having a new little baby. It's just, God, man, just like makes you appreciate everything.
Yeah, my morning run thoughts have changed since my wife got pregnant. You know, because like, oh, my morning runs, that's my moment of solitude.
Yeah.
That's when I do some thinking. And I don't even necessarily try to do certain deep thinking exercises. Like issues in my life will just find me during that morning run.
Yeah.
And then I will navigate those issues by the end of that run or I'll carry them to the next run. And before my wife got pregnant, it was just thinking about like business and creative ideas and how can we build the team? Who do I need to work with on the team? How do we grow this part of the business? And I thought of and created a lot of solutions and identified a lot of problems in the business during those morning runs. They were powerful. I think those morning runs alone have grown this business. And then when my wife got pregnant, my morning run thoughts at solitude evolved into, well, what kind of father do I want to be? And I heard you say something in an interview that was one of the most important characteristics you can have is to be dependable. You're dependable on yourself, for other people, for your family. And that's how I feel right now is, okay, this baby girl that's coming in July, she depends on me to show up and be successful and lead her and show her. So I'd love to like really dive into now the evolution of how you found endurance training and how that evolved your life, you know, coming off of this childhood and this trauma and anxiety and then going through this addiction. And then now you find endurance training and it almost seems like you were able to like funnel this pressure into this thing that was this outlet that you could then just like hammer down on and release some sort of tension. Is that what that was?
For sure. It's hard to be a competitive endurance athlete when you're like whacked out on opioids. It raises your heart rate. It just jams up everything. It's not conducive. And that became my almost like identity. It was just that I am a disciplined person. I'm going to live a life of discipline and solitude if that's what it takes. And I'm just going to handle my business. I had to just get extremely basic with my lifestyle because I'm constantly on the move and it's easy to get tripped up in all the different things I'm trying to work on and have the anxiety from you know, a problem with this project or this deal isn't going great. And that anxiety starts to creep in and I'm like, oh, I just don't want to feel like this, man. It's like mental health. I just don't want to feel like just calm the voice, quiet the voices in my head. And the only other thing I've found outside of drugs is endurance sports and just being out suffering on my own. 90% of the training that I do is on my own. You know, I don't have a problem running with people. People always want to run. Either they say they want to run, and then when I tell them, okay, let's do it, and they're like, nah, I think they think we're going to run race pace every time. And I'm like, you realize, like, if I ask you to run, I am going to run your pace. If you ask me to run, you should be prepared to run my pace. So, you know, it's like running protocols or etiquette. But yeah, when I discovered endurance sports, especially when I started to get some positive feedback, I was like, okay, I found something that I can really lean into, and it's a good distraction from, you know, my own demons I was dealing with. And it also sets a good example for my children. And, you know, you always have, like you were talking about having your first daughter, and you always think about, fantasize about how everything is going to be. And whatever you think it's going to be is probably going to be like a fragment of that. And I always envision, oh, when the kids get older, they're going to come and see me win races. They're going to be so excited. They're going to run down the finishing chute with me. And it couldn't be further from the truth when they've come to just expect me to win. So if I don't win, they're like, Dad, you got second? And I'm like, dude, the kid was like a professional 27-year-old kid. I'm 51 years old. And they're like, well, it was still a good effort, Dad, but man, I kind of thought you were going to win. And they're dead serious. And I'm like, oh.
But you're like, they're superhero.
Yeah. They don't, you know,
they,
it's funny.
The superhero to always win and yeah. succeed.
It's funny because I know that that's how they feel about me, but they like, it's like covert, but overtly they're like, oh, Dad, enough. Like, I don't want to hear this. But when I hear them talking, when my wife tells me if they're talking about me when I'm not there, they're like, I'm like the superhero. But I'm like, oh, how come they don't act like that when they're with me? They're like, I think sometimes in their defense, I can be very intense and like very disciplinary when it comes to rules. Like if we go out to dinner, I'm like, guys, no one wants to be around you in a restaurant. When I go to a restaurant and I sit down and someone's there with their kids, I'm like, oh, can you not sit us with them? I came here to get away from my own kids. I always tell people, no one likes your kids except you. And even that's debatable sometimes. When kids are at that young age, they're a lot of work. So when we go somewhere with them, inevitably people will come up to my wife or to me and be like, these are the best behaved kids I've ever seen. I said, oh yeah, that's because I've threatened them with physical violence if they don't. But it's my responsibility. If I take my kids to eat and you're there with your wife trying to have a nice quiet dinner, who am I to come in and ruin your experience going out to eat? So when we do things like that, I'm using dinner as an example, but even if we go to a sporting events or anything, they are. And I'm proud of them, and I'm proud of what my wife has done mainly, but they're disciplined. They respect other people's experience, and they are like really well-behaved. I mean, they still make mistakes, but if there's one thing that I'm proud of, it's the way that they represent us. And I always tell them, like, guys, we're on the same team. When we're out there, represent our team. Don't let people think like, oh, those rideout kids are pain in the ass or blah, blah, blah. I said, be the first person onto the field. Be the first person off the field. Represent yourself. Be dependable. Let people know that they know what they're getting when you show up. Discipline and hard work. Yes, we want to have fun, but we also want to be like responsible people. Be a good person. Help other people. So that's the kind of stuff that we preach. But
I respect that a lot. I've had conversations with my wife about that. Like how we, because, you know, we go out to dinner and
yep.
we see people just, they're on their phones and their kids are making a mess. So me and my wife have conversations like how we want to parent our kids. And I would never speak freely on social media about this until I actually have kids.
Yeah.
Because I know if I did, the response would be, you just wait.
Yeah.
You just wait and see. But I know there's people that are doing it the right way and instill values in their kids.
You tell them, I don't have to wait. I know right from wrong. I know that my kids shouldn't be making you have an inconvenient time or an unpleasant time at a restaurant or a sporting event because my kids don't behave because I don't want to tell them no. Like, what? Then don't bring them out. Control this. Like, I don't, why should I be subjected to your bad behavior? That's how I view it when I take them places. And honestly, I'm like, this one thing I'm super proud of is the job we've done with like getting them to behave like nice kids. They are genuinely like nice people. They can be nasty to each other, but when we're out in public, they're really nice to each other. And that makes me super happy. And I always tell my kids, you know what you can have in this house? If you do all the right things and you behave and you get good grades and you like are a good person, what can we have, Dad? Anything you want. They're like, what about go to Disney? I said, I'll tell you what, if everyone gets straight A's, we'll go to Disney. What else do you want? Electric bikes. Sure. What do you think is a reasonable request? And inevitably, they never do it. I'm like, you know, someone will punch someone else in the face. And I'm like, well, strike one, two, and three. Like, I told you not to hit each other. If you have that much of a problem, come and talk to me and we'll figure it out. But we're not going to punch each other in the face. And they, you know, for a while they would, you know, if they got in a fight, I'd make them put on the boxing gloves and fight with each other, thinking that they would be like, all right, forget it. We don't really want to fight. But then after they like busted each other up a few times, I'm like, oh, I can't do that anymore. Like literally the same one gets a black eye every time.
Did you get into boxing before you got into triathlon?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Way before. I got into boxing in high school in, like early in high school, mainly because I was so afraid of fighting, like everyone. But I was like, I don't want to be consumed by that fear and let it dictate the course of my life. So I went to a boxing gym, just walked in like exactly as intimidating as anyone would imagine and be like, hi, I want to learn how to box. And I always tell people with anything to do with fear of trying something new, I can promise you that at some point Mike Tyson walked into a gym for the first time and felt uncomfortable. And that goes for any That goes for Dustin Poirier in MMA. That goes for any fighter that you know. Tim Kennedy, at some point, they walked into a gym and they were scared. They just processed the fear differently than others. And I didn't like the fact that that fear was controlling me. And I was like, I don't want to get into fights, but if I do, I don't want to get run over. I want to at least know what I'm doing. So I started boxing at the Somerville Boxing Club, which eventually produced heavyweight world champion John. Why am I spacing on his name? He lost to Roy Jones eventually. Johnny the Quiet Man Ruiz. And yeah, they were good fighters there. And then when I got to college, I kind of stopped because I was playing football and hockey. So from middle of August till the end of the school year, I practiced every single day, either for football or hockey, both Division III NCAA sports. And then I moved to New York and boxed for the New York Athletic Club. So we would fight against like the Downtown Athletic Club, Long Island Athletic Club. Downtown Athletic Club was the one that used to give out the Heisman at the time.
Did you at any point want to pursue boxing to professional level?
No, I sucked. I hated it. I was scared all the time, but I just figured I'm going to keep going until the fear dissipates, and it never does.
And then when you found endurance training, that was through, I think it was cycling first.
Yeah.
And then triathlon.
Yep.
Get the bug with triathlon.
Yeah.
You did triathlon for nearly a decade, right?
Yep. Roughly. Yeah. 2010, roughly to now about 7 years, 6, 7 years. And, it's funny. I was just in an interview with Matt Futterman, who's the sports editor for the New York Times. And we were going through the timeline. So I pulled up Athlinks to make sure I had all the dates right. But the first time I, qualified and went to Hawaii, which was my goal, as soon as I saw it on TV and started to get into cycling, I'm like, I'm doing that Ironman in Hawaii. And of course you tell people in the triathlon community and they look at you like you're crazy. In the same way I'd look at someone who was like, I just got into triathlon, I'm going to go to Kona. I'm like, okay, let's see. We'll see about that. It's incredibly hard to qualify and it's an incredibly hard race. But that race in 2012 changed the trajectory of my life massively because it was just an epic, epic failure. I qualified, got there. It was like I was at the Olympics. I was so just psyched to be there. I was so proud of myself. And, you know, you're hanging out with all the triathlon, just the biggest triathlon dweebs in the world, of which I was one of them, obviously. But man, looking back, what a bunch of nerds. They're just so into everything and FTP and those guys had a data point for everything. I never even looked at heart rate. They're like, what's your FTP? How many watts you putting out? I'm like, oh, for Christ's sakes. I had everything. Power meter on my bike, like the best SRM. I had best everything. But I just never looked at those metrics. I just did everything by feel. So I qualified in 2012, got there, super excited. Go out, of course, way too hard on the bike and got off the bike and started running in around mile 3 or 4. I'm coming down a Leahy Drive where my wife was staying with my two oldest kids at the time. They were babies. And she's videoing me with the phone and I'm way behind where I wanted to be and I'm suffering like a dog. And I just made the decision to quit right there. Like I just didn't finish the race. I was just like, I can't do it. I'm dying. I'm just going to stop. And she was like, what? Even at the time, she was like, are you crazy? Are you sure? you don't want to just try and walk and see if you get better. I'm like, nah, I'm doing terrible. I almost had like a professional athlete mentality of like, if I'm not going to be in the money, I'm not going to finish. And it was, you know, one of the worst decisions of my life, but it changed me. It changed me. It made me become the person that I am now that would never, ever in a million years quit at anything. But sometimes you need a kick in the ass to remind you that everything isn't as good as it seems. Even when you think things are good, it can always be better and it can always be worse. And there's been many great fighters who've come back from a loss and become the best fighter in the world. And I talk about Dustin Poirier in this regard all the time. He got knocked out by, I don't know if he got knocked out or I think he got knocked out or stopped by Conor McGregor. And like a few years later, he went back to the drawing board, like basically dug in and just got tough and won an interim title in after that loss and then came back and just beat the brakes off McGregor two times in a row. And, you know, I would argue that that loss made him the fighter that he is. And there's been a lot of examples like that throughout the course of boxing and MMA history. And that quitting and getting beat in, getting beaten in Kona in 2012 was just horribly embarrassing, mortifying, but it motivated me like crazy to never let that happen again. And it hasn't. And if I've left a race early, it's been in an ambulance, but I've never like voluntarily said, nah, I'm not feeling it today. Matter of fact, in so after the race, I said to my wife, oh my God, I can't believe this. And she had said, this is a one-time deal because it took so much time. And she didn't want to like put up with the bullshit of like doing everything while I was training all weekend. And after that, when I told her, I'm like, you know, basically it was like on the verge of tears. I might even have been crying. And she was like, if it's that important, just do it again. And I was like, done. I'm doing it again. And I went the following year, qualified at Ironman Canada and did 9:36 in Whistler. And then I went to Kona and did a 9:39, which is, you know, I would have liked to have been 9 minutes faster, but all things considered, that was a result that I can live with and I was proud of. And then I went back in 16 with ideas of winning the age group. And I thought I could. I was training like crazy. We had moved to California. I was training. Everything was perfect. And I got pneumonia 3 weeks before the race. And I mean, I thought I was going to die. Like pneumonia is a scary shit. I've had it a few times, it's like a lung disease. People think it's like a cold, but it's more like just severe asthma. You can't really breathe. And so anyway, I had the pneumonia. I was out for a week and then I had 2 weeks to prepare. Basically, like I was still dragging my ass, but I went and did the best I could. It was a disaster, but I walked the majority of the marathon, finished in like 11 hours. But after that 2012 episode, I'm like, I'll be the last person out here on like NBC being like with a glow stick around my neck if I have to. But thank God I finished right before the sun went down and saved myself from having to like walk in the dark. And yeah, but I could live with that because I knew I did everything I could and some things are out of your control. So it's not the end of the world. You're going to have bad races as long as you do everything that you can to like represent yourself and be dependable, which is what I did. And then I turned my sights on just pure running from that point in 2016. So all through 17, I did do another race in 17. I did the 70.3 in Hawaii. And that was actually one of my best races ever. The time wasn't great, like 4:30 something, but I was seventh overall in the entire race, won my age group. And, had I had a better swim there, I could have won that race, the whole thing.
2012, when you stepped off during Kona, was it instant regret?
Immediate. I was like, oh, should I just get back out there? And then I was like, nah. I talked myself out of it like just a wimp. I was like, nah, you're already off the course. And like I just made every excuse like a classic weakling. I just convinced myself that it was fine.
And then after that, it was game one. Like I'm never
different person.
That mistake.
Oh yeah, different person emerged.
Because when you know, when I hear you talk about running now, and I think it's a very unique and refreshing approach to running from anyone else I've heard in the community, is you run like a fighter. Like you run like a boxer.
Yeah.
And for a lot of people, when you go out and run a race, you're racing just yourself, which I'm sure you are. But at the same time, like you approach every race like it's war and it's a fight.
Yes.
And you're fighting everyone out there to beat them.
Hell yes.
Why that mindset?
That's my process. That's what I have to do to get my head right around pushing yourself to the limit and staying on the limit for like, you know, on a marathon, 2.5 hours of like basically running at a pace that doesn't seem sustainable. You're kind of like, I always tell people to run fast, you have to start fast, but you don't want to go too fast. So it's always like a roll of the dice. Did I go too hard too early? When I ran 2:28, I ran a 1:13 and 1:15. In a perfect world, I would have ran 1:15, 1:13. You should always finish faster. But when you're fit and ready at the marathon, it's very easy to go a step or two too hard too early. And the next thing you know, you're in a deficit that you're never getting out of. No amount of willpower can get you through it. And at the Boston Marathon's perfect example, I finished in 2:30:21. For the last 3 miles, I knew this was going to be razor close. So I couldn't have tried a step harder. And as it clicked over past 2:30, as I'm coming down Boylston, there was nothing I could do. And when I crossed the finish line, like I was destroyed. I was like violently sick, throwing up. Like as soon as they said wheelchair, I was like, hell no to the wheelchair. I'll rather go in an ambulance. I'm not getting in on a wheelchair, because that has happened. And, but yeah, that's the mindset I have to get into to get to that dark place of like knowing what's coming is like, this is a fight, even if it's just against myself. But you know, I try to be kind and respectful to everyone, but in a race, I am, I don't want to say a bully or a dick, but I'm certainly not like everyone's best friend. I'm like, we're doing this, you know? And I don't think a lot of people are used to having that level of aggression or that mindset around them when we get locked into a battle, if it's like just two of us running for a win.
Yeah. When I've heard you talk about some of these races, I've heard you talk about it. It's almost like you empty your tank completely on every one of these races. And you see a lot of people crossing the finish line pretty comfortable, right? Like there's this in endurance training in sports and races, it's this conservative approach almost in a lot of sense of go out, feel comfortable, be in control. When you're emptying your tank, do you still feel like you're in control of the race the whole time? Or are you redlining to the point where if you pushed one more step further, you'd burn out?
I don't feel like I'm a completely out of control of the pace until the last, let's say in Boston, I would say maybe the last 3 miles, I was like, damn, it's out of my control now. Now all I've got is like determination. My body's not working the way it's supposed to. My legs aren't responding. I'm kind of like a little awkward. My form is shit. And if I can't respond, if someone ran past me, like I don't have the glycogen to respond to them. When things go right and you do have that glycogen and you do have a little left, you know, at a mile to go, let's say in half marathon, you're all in. So when I cross the finish line, it's always like, oh, like almost like a huge relief, like I'm ready to collapse. But sometimes that only lasts, like I just have my hands on my knees for a few seconds and I recover quickly. But in the last couple marathons, Boston and New York in particular, I was like violently sick, like throwing up whatever I had, very little water and stuff in my stomach, but it's violently retching and like, oh my God, like a moment, always that moment of like, holy shit, am I dying? Like what? I feel terrible and it's like uncontrollable. You know, your body is just doing things that you are completely out of control that I've never seen before, because that getting to that like level of depletion is, you would never be able to do that in training.
One thing I heard you say is everyone shows up race day fit.
Yeah.
Everyone's fit, but who's the healthiest?
That's right.
Have you found that as you've gotten older, it's harder to show up race day, even with a taper, even with the program, to show up healthy?
Every single race is unique and different. I've always feel like I have some little like tweaks going on at New York. My right calf had like locked in a spasm the week of the race. And I mean, it was excruciating pain. Like I was like, man, what? I knew what it was doing, but I was like, why won't this muscle like release? It was like contracted and it wouldn't let go. And after like several intense physical therapy sessions of like grinding it out and ART, it eventually like released enough to race. And then at the race, mile 1 and 2, I was like, oh my God, I'm going to have to take the subway home. My calf isn't working. And then all of a sudden at like mile 4, it just completely released and the pain went away and I was off and running. So it's the strangest thing. Like sometimes these aches and pains pop up in the most inopportune moments, but just like, again, that's all part of the mindset, is knowing how to like roll with the punches and what is normal and what's abnormal, what's a real injury and what's just like aches and pains.
I always find like two, three weeks before every race, no matter what race it is, something flares up. And I don't know if it's an actual flare up, an injury, or if it's some, I'm hyper aware of my body.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's it. I've prepped this whole time for months. I'm not going to be able to run a race because I can't even run. Like a few months ago, prior to Leadville 100, it was like 3 weeks prior to Leadville 100, 100 miles in the Rocky Mountains. I was like, I just need to go out into this race as healthy as possible. Mazda came down. He was in Austin. And we were going to do a 10-mile run around Lady Bird Lake, downtown Austin. And I was having this pulling, like, movement on my, like, the teardrop in my quad. I was pulling on my knee, and it was giving me a little bit of pain. Me and Mazda went out for this run, and, like, instantly I could feel it. Mile one, I could feel it. Mile three, I think I mentioned to him, like, my quad's, like, killing me. Mile five, I had to stop. I couldn't run. This was three weeks out from Leadville. I was like, holy shit. The fuck am I going to run 100 miles in 3 weeks? But you know what? Before the race, it goes away. It clears up. So I just expect that now going into a race that something's going to flare up. Not a matter of if, but when. But I know race day, it's gone.
Yeah. I think that's part of like the build is putting so much miles on your body that you're breaking your body down so much and then hoping that the like 2 weeks prior to the race, the taper will allow it to recover and be ready to race. So it's almost like should be expected that there should be some issue because you're pushing your body way beyond what you normally would. And that's part of the preparation process. And as you get, I find as I've gotten more experience and as anyone gets more experience, your body learns to adjust and adapt to that workload. And one of the other things that I do is I always run in the morning fasted. I never eat before I run, even long, hard runs. I don't eat anything. I'll take one gel on like a 22-mile run, take it halfway through, and I'll try to hit some waters, bubblers throughout the park system in Nashville where I live. But in the summer, obviously, I'll hit them more. I'm not trying to do like dangerous shit, like get too dehydrated. But when in the spring, late winter, early spring, I would easily go 22 miles and not have any water or even a gel if it was just a long, steady run. And then I would just eat when I got home and try to like, you know, you don't want to like get too depleted because then it takes a long time, as you know, with a supplement company. You don't want to get too depleted and then trying to recover and play catch up all the time. But I like the idea of training my body to use like to burn fat and run efficiently and get used to not having calories. So then at a race, I would eat something like oatmeal, bananas, and like some kind of like slow burning carbs before the race, hours before, so that then all of a sudden now my body's used to running on zero. Now all of a sudden I've got some calories in there and it's not, and it's like, you know, too much to my benefit. I have found that works for me.
Yeah. I did a podcast with Dr. James D. Nicolantonio a few weeks ago, and he was talking about in his book, his book's called Win, has a big section on nutrition and performance in regards to endurance training. And there's a big piece in that for dehydration acclimation, heat acclimation, and glycogen depletion acclimation. So there's benefits of going out on a run and dehydrating yourself a little bit, or going out in some heat and acclimating the heat, or running off of running fasted and getting your body to acclimate in those conditions. There's benefits of it easily, 100% studied.
Yeah. The crazy thing is a lot of this stuff, like I don't have a scientific approach to anything. I never look at heart rate. I never look at any metrics other than like pace and duration. And I've just experimented with different methodologies of my training over the years. And I've now found something that works, and I've been able to avoid injuries and recover and continue to improve.
So you do 10 miles, 10 miles a day, like your baseline?
Yeah, I was just added up the numbers the other day, actually. It's funny you should ask. And I have been averaging 10.7 miles per day for this since through whatever, May 15th.
And then you do a Saturday long run, or is it the same thing?
Yeah, no, exactly. So I do now. I haven't been riding my bike since I've been in Nashville. It's just not conducive to cycling. It's where we live. I just feel like the roads are small. No one's like, there's no other cyclists out there. I don't want to be the one that like, someone in a big truck is like, F this biker, and like runs me off the road or something on some country road in the middle of nowhere. When I was in LA, at least there was heavy traffic. If someone hit me with the cars, the next person might see me. I might be out in the country there and get hit by a car and no one would even know I'm out there. So I've been just running. But yeah, typically it's 10 miles a day and then a long run on Saturday.
How many
enduring marathon builds, it might be like 10 to 15 every day with a long run. So like track day might be 13, 14 miles just because it takes all those miles to get the track work in.
How many of those days do you wake up not wanting to run?
Never. Never even crosses my mind. Not even. When I say never, I know to some people it might sound crazy, but it's just my reality. I'd never, ever. I mean, we go skiing for a week in Aspen. I ran every single day before we skied with the kids. I'd get up and run before they wake up so I could get it over with. It's just part of my non-negotiables. It doesn't even enter my mind to think like, I don't want to do it. The only thing that enters my mind is how bad is the weather and should I run on the treadmill? And inevitably, since I've been in Nashville, no matter what the conditions are, I've gone out. Matter of fact, in January, I was running in the snow and I fell down. I had an old shoulder injury where I had slightly torn rotator cuff and I fell in the snow and it just destroyed my shoulder, tore the labrum, rotator cuff. So 8 weeks before Boston, I had a major shoulder surgery. And they told me, don't do anything for 4 weeks. Don't take your arm out of your sling, nothing. After 4 days, I was like, yo, I can't do it. I have to go run. I put a belt around my neck, held onto the belt with my bad arm. It was still stitches and swollen, and I just started jogging. And the next day, I jogged 10 miles. Then the next day, I ran 10 miles. Then, like, a week later, I did, like, 15 miles at, like, 6:30 pace with my arm in a sling, just legging it. But I was like, it was like motivating to me that I was like, all right, now we have some real adversity. It was almost like, all right, we've been training. Now the war is on. Let's go. This is where we like cash in all those mental toughness chips. And I wasn't trying to like be a tough guy or ruin the work that the guy had done on my shoulder. But he told me, as long as you don't pull the anchors out of the bone where they stitched the, they put the screws into the top of my arm bone and then anchored the tendons down. Same with the labrum. He's like, as long as those screws don't pull out, you're good. So I was like, okay, if my arm is supported and they don't pull out, I'm just going to go do this. And the first time I told him I was running, he was like very, very angry and didn't believe me. And I was like, so I just never brought it up again. Cause he was like, when I say angry, he was like, listen, I told you not to F around. This is not a game. Like, don't run. And I was like, oh, okay. I got you. Needless to say, I was like, all right, bye. I went to like one or two physical therapy sessions and it was so timid and tame. I was like, come on, dude, like I can do this at my house. I don't have to come all the way down here to do this like half-assed passive motion. I just started rehabbing it myself. I just looked everything up online, started to do physical therapy. And then 8 weeks later, I was back to like doing super light bench press. And the guy I bought my house from played for the Titans for a couple of years. He was number one first round draft pick out of Ole Miss, offensive lineman. He had the same exact surgery from the same guy. And I was telling him, I was like, oh yeah, 8 weeks I was able to bench press. And he was almost incredulous. He's like, dude, I couldn't do anything. I couldn't even sleep in my bed for 6 weeks. I was in a recliner. I couldn't do anything. I can't believe it. And I'm like, I don't know. I've just like take my supplements, training. I just kept moving and I did all the exercises I was supposed to do. And eventually it just got better.
Has your mindset always been that strong? Or do you think over time, because I'm a big fan of Tim Grover's book, Winning.
Yep.
And he talks about, you know, he was a coach for Kobe and Jordan. And he talks about like your first win, for example, like, you know, you get your first win and with that first win, you build confidence and then to get that second win, you have to sacrifice more, but that second win builds more confidence. And the third win, you have to sacrifice even more, but it keeps building more confidence. And over time, you do this for 5, 10, 15, 20 years. After those 20 years, you're a confident motherfucker. You've yeah. sacrificed a lot. Do you think it's been that way with you where you've achieved these chips, if you will? You know, you cash in these chips now. These chips like you've built are, or these bricks are these mental and physical chips that you're just building up and they make you stronger and more durable and more resilient. And you're just not fazed by, you wake up and it's raining and you don't think about not running or running. It's, what do I wear?
Yeah.
You know, do you think that's the time?
That's exactly my thought process. And I've been lucky in that as I've started to win more races and have better results, I have a apparel sponsor in a brand called Say Sky, SaySky. I wear it at all the races. If anyone has seen pictures from recent races and They reached out to me. They was a friend of mine, a Danish friend of mine who sold his supplement company and moved to Beverly Hills. He's such a funny guy, Pierre. He's a cool guy. He's probably the same age as me, but I was hanging out with him. We would go for a mountain bike ride in the Palisades where we live, Pacific Palisades, in between Santa Monica and Malibu. And I was like, dude, how did you end up here? And it's so strange. Like, you're not working. It's clear you had some success. And he's like, yeah, I sold my company. And I was like, I'm moving to Beverly Hills. Didn't know, never been there. He just bought a house sight unseen, moved to Beverly Hills, and then eventually moved over to the Palisades. But just the nicest guy. And he introduced me to the founder of this brand. Oh, he was friends with him and said, you should be working with this guy, Ken. He's nuts. He's like got the best mindset. Like, you'd like him. And I had some decent results, but I hadn't like made any noise at like any of the major marathons. And the guy reached out and was like, hey, do you want to represent us? We'll give you all the apparel and everything and some other like benefits. And I was like, hell yeah, definitely. I was so proud that someone wanted to be affiliated with me that I was like, since then, other brands have come to me and offered me other incentives to wear their clothes. And I'm like, nah, I'm not motivated by money. I'm motivated by the quality of my relationships. And this guy wanted to give me stuff when I couldn't get arrested. And I was like, I'll pay him for the stuff before, not a knock on anyone else. But I was like, you put your bet on me. I'm going to help you bury a body if I have to. Like, we're friends, you know, and this goes back to being dependable. If you're in business with me, we're in business together. I am not going to compromise my integrity for any amount of money because I've already made enough mistakes that I can't live with and look at myself when I think about them. I don't need to make more mistakes, not when it comes to money. I've never been, of course I want to make money and live a nice life and have a comfort, but not at the sacrifice of my integrity. I don't want money. Not that bad. I'd rather have pride and be able to like be dependable and have people say like, yeah, no matter what you have to say about that guy, he's a straight shooter. He's a good person. He's going to tell you the truth.
And has that evolved over time?
Or was for sure. I mean, not that I was ever a shitty person. I think I was always a good person, but it's, you know, you have to go through trials and tribulations of life. Like I said, having money and losing it is worse than never having it. And when I was living in London, I ran commodities, European and Asian commodity sales at a young age, sales and trading for Cantor Fitzgerald. So I was living in London, flying back and forth from London to New York on the Concorde. I was like living a fantasy life like someone else. It was mind blowing. And then Enron, who was one of our big customers, that scandal went down. And basically I was more or less out of a job and had to reinvent myself. And I told you how hard it was to get onto a trading desk in commodities. And in that business, you're only as good as the quality of your relationships in that specific, you know, trading domain. So now all of a sudden trying to go get into fixed income, for instance, which is what I ended up doing, is structured credit and correlation sales and trading. You know, it was a whole new group of people, very sophisticated intellects. And that was just a whole nother long story. But it's like over time of going through these types of ups and downs, you just see a lot of things and you see a lot of behavior from people, some that you like and some that you don't like. And one of the things that, like I said, you mentioned earlier, is being dependable, if nothing else. And in working alongside Teddy Atlas has helped drive this home, is that if nothing else, just be dependable to your friends, be loyal, be a good person, and the rest of it will take care of itself. You may miss some opportunities, but I'm not going to make decisions to do certain types of business at the detriment of relationships with other people, if that makes sense.
It makes sense. I think one of the big key takeaways is no one's going to care about your goals as much as you do.
Yeah.
All right, like, We put these things out in the air. We manifest these things. We have these visions. I'm a big visionary person. I see where I want to go next, and then I build a plan to get there. And I see where I want to be in a year, 3 years, 5 years, and it's backwards planning. How do I get there? What do I need to do in order to get there? And it's really easy to think that all the people around you care as much as you do about what you're trying to do. So why aren't they buying into it? Why don't they believe me? The truth is, no one's ever going to care as much as you do. And when you finally understand and believe that, it's go all in on yourself, bet on yourself, be dependable to the people around you.
Yeah.
And see where it takes you.
Yeah, I posted a motivational clip once. I mean, I heard a speaker and I used the audio. I'm like the least sophisticated social media person in the world. I'm always so jealous of all the stuff you have. I'm like, man, I wish I had someone to help me with this. But anyway, I pulled these like little quotes occasionally. And there was one, I put it over a video of me winning the Pasadena Marathon. I'm just running along and one of my really good friends and was initially a customer and a big wig at Western Asset Management, like super nice guy, just incredibly successful. And he was out there on the race course. And you know, to people that are my age that don't know me from running, when I tell them I'm running the Pasadena Marathon, all of a sudden they see me come by with the motorcycles and you can't even see the people behind me. They're like, I hear them talking to their colleagues like, dude, you're not going to believe this. He said he won the race, 9,000 people. It was on TV. It finished in the Rose Bowl. And I'm always like, man, when you say it like that, it does sound cool. But to me, I was just, this is what I do. What happened is exactly what I thought was going to happen. But anyway, I took a clip that he made and sent me on text of just me running by. And his name is Mike Buchanan, but we call him Bucky. So as I ran back, I put my hands up like the like shrugging, like I was like, what the buck? Where is everybody? And he was laughing. So I put a quote over that said like, no one's going to care about your goals and dreams until you've already achieved them. No one is going to care about hearing that you think you can do this and do that until you've already achieved it. So there's a lot of like lonely nights and like, you're going to have to work a long time by yourself with no one caring. But then once you do start winning, now people care. So there's always that fine line of like, it's easy to be like, F these people. When I win, I'm going to tell them to all go suck it and blah, blah, blah. But as soon as you have some success and those same people that have not necessarily been dicks, but haven't been allies either. And now all of a sudden they want to kind of get on the train like, oh, dude, you did it. Like, what's up? Can we go to a fight together? You know, like weird, crazy shit. The old me would have been like, dude, do you know how much I hate you? You're an idiot. Like, you've never supported me one thing. Now, all of a sudden, it's convenient to be my friend because you see the stuff I'm doing and it looks interesting and looks entertaining to you. But like I said, you always think about, like, I'm going to go scorched earth on these sons of bitches when the time is right. But then when you've had some success, you just kind of, like, rise above it. Like, yeah, all right, man, what's up? Thanks for the support. Take care. And just keep it moving. You know what I mean? It's like, I just, I don't know. Maybe that is, like I said, I always am looking for the mistakes that I'm making. But if I've done anything right, it's that I've been able to kind of let some of that shit go as I've gotten older. And success will do that to you. It'll make you like forgive a lot of transgressions because it's almost like sad. The people that were like doubted you, or I'm not trying to paint the picture that people like, you'll never be anything. But certainly I didn't have like a room full of cheerleaders. And now, not that I do now, but now I definitely have people that pay attention to what I do. And it's like, I don't know, I've outgrown that anger and now it's more like feelings of gratitude and maturity where anyone sends me a DM or messages, I'm so appreciative of them. I'm like, oh man, I appreciate the support and everything. And, you know, but there, of course, there are some people you just never forget. You never forget, but I don't have to tell them, they know. And it's sad for them that now they're like, they want to be your buddy when they know and you know they weren't always the most supportive people in your life.
Yeah, it's like, where do you want to spend your energy? Is it worth the time?
Exactly. It's not worth it.
I remember when I started BPN, I was in college, you know, it was 2012. And I've told this story many times before, but I'll never forget it. I started the business when I was in college. We went back home, which was about 3.5 hours from college. It was Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. I went to school out near Pittsburgh. And we went into downtown Harrisburg one night. It was a Friday night. And we went into this bar. And that bar had a bunch of friends from my high school that graduated a year before me. So we walk in this bar, and at the time I'm trying to build this business. I'm posting on social media, just getting it out there, doing whatever I can.
Yeah.
It had no traction, right? I walk into this bar and everyone's chanting BPN, all these guys. And I was like, oh shit, like they're supporting me. And I quickly realized they were making fun of me. They're laughing, they're chanting BPN, they're making jokes about it.
Just hearing you tell that story makes me think, like, where are these dickheads? I'll beat the shit out of them. I don't know why. Like, that's my first reaction. It's like, oh, you think it's funny, motherfucker? Get over here. Think you're going to poo-poo my dreams? What are you doing, you fucking loser?
Yeah, I'll never forget that moment. And I think about that routinely, you know, when...
Would motivate the shit out of me. Like, how dare that? I'm insulted for you. How dare you try to, like, shit on my dreams? Where are they now? They're probably asking you for a free protein bar.
Yeah, but it's like... I saw you know, you see where you want to take something. You see the vision. And like you said, people don't believe or buy into you until you actually get there.
Yep.
And it's a lonely road. And that's where a lot of the loneliness is. It's one of the best parts of running. That is solitude. You are suffering in solitude. And then you suffer in solitude for weeks, months, years. And then you take your first marathon, might be 4 hours, 30 minutes. And one day you run a sub 3 hour marathon. People see the sub 3, but they don't see what it took to shave off an hour and a half off that run.
Of course.
You apply that to anything in your life, right?
100%. If it's important enough to you, we live in the greatest country on earth. You can do anything you want here, period. If you want it bad enough, you can do it. And I mean, just look at what I've done with running. I'm not a great athlete. I just decided it was important to me and I did this. And that goes, if someone had the same passion for that same entrepreneurial spirit, they'd start a business. I was telling my kids this the other day. I said, we live in such an awesome country. If there's something that you loved more than anything, like fishing, if you really love fishing, you could create a YouTube channel and then create your own line of fishing devices. But there's so many people doing it. You have to want to win more than you want to be alive. You have to want to kill everyone in the space, and you can't fake your way through that. So it's very important that you figure out what it is that you're passionate about, what you want to do, and then attack. And I've never believed this more than I do now at this stage of my life, only because I've seen it manifested in my own work with running. I had no idea where it was going. It's funny. There were people close to me, like in our family, they kind of looked down at my training, like, look at this selfish asshole out here training all the time. Like, I know what they were saying. Like, hey, he's got three kids. He gets up and trains, is taking time from them. Now, all of a sudden that, like, you know, I've got an article coming out in the New York Times and I've been on different shows, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, dude, you're killing it. Wow, good for you. A complete paradigm shift. All of a sudden I'm like the coolest guy they know. And I'm like, yeah, weren't you the same guy who was like looking at me like I was an asshole for like wanting to like achieve certain physical goals? Like, didn't you, like, almost like they had an attitude, like, why didn't you get that out of your system when you were younger? I'm like, I am young. Until I'm dead, I'll be finding things to like strive for. Why should you be concerned with what I'm doing? Worry about yourself. But I'll never forget the feeling that some people made me, like, bestowed upon me, because they didn't understand what I was doing, or it wasn't how they wanted to live their lives. But I also don't want to be mediocre and average, and I don't want to be, I've made a career out of being interesting. That my running success and the success I've had with the podcast with Teddy Ellis, that's all contributed to who I am, and it's made me more interesting, and it's helped my professional life immensely. And I always joke with people that I've made a whole career out of being interesting. I have no other marketable skills. No one's looking for me to run analysis or build a PowerPoint presentation. That stuff is like kryptonite to me. But if you need to find a solution to your problem, whether it's raising capital or debt or finding the right investors, like, I'm the guy. If I can't do it, I know the guy who can. And, I don't want to sound like an arrogant dick. I tried to be humble, but I know what I'm good at and what I'm not good at. And solving problems, I'm good at.
Dependable.
If you need something done, I'm your guy. If I tell you I can do it, rest assured that I'm either going to do it, find someone who can do it, or die trying. Because I wouldn't tell you I could do it if I didn't think it was realistic.
I love it, Ken. I appreciate you, man. Thanks for everything. And
thank you, man.
I'm wishing you the best of luck in all your future races. I know you're going sub 2 hours eventually. I know it's coming.
Sub 2 hours. Well, listen, good luck in Buffalo, man. What is your time goal there?
I'm going for a sub 250 on this one.
Oh, damn.
Yep.
Well, then don't run faster than a 125 in the first half.
Yeah, I'll keep it in mind.
All right. Good luck, man. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Bear Performance Podcast. Please leave a rating and review on the platform you are listening to if you enjoyed it. It helps us to grow and reach more people with the intent of changing lives through the Go One More mindset. If you are ready to take your health and performance to the next level, head over to bpnsubs.com to take the first step.